Today, we are going to look at the figure of Moses, and we are going to talk about the story of the Exodus. This event, the Exodus event, is the classic text of liberation theology. That is the text which is used as the gospel, as it were, of the Old Testament for such people, both in South America and in Africa and in India and in black theology. The Exodus event is the event. So I'm not saying anything new when I say that this is a passage which is fundamental to reading the Bible from the bottom. It's very much the basic text. So I'm not trying to convince people of that, but what I would like to do in reading some of the texts about the Exodus is to look at the process of liberation of the oppressed people that happens in this text. The stages of liberation, how they go through it, and recognize that it wasn't just God took them out of Egypt, that it was a lot more that went on in this struggle for God to rescue his people from the Egyptians. Now, as a preliminary item, and I'd like to refer to another book in this connection, there's another book which has recently come out, which is doing what I'm trying to do, although I had no idea about this particular book when I started doing it. It's called Unexpected News by Robert McAfee Brown. The subtitle is Reading the Bible with Third World Eyes. It's an example of what I'm doing. It takes a series of passages like this and reads them. Now, they're not the same passages that I'm using, but it does essentially the same thing, and it's written very simply and very clearly. And he makes the point, which I wanted to make also, in connection with this passage, that what you have here is a clear example of a class struggle. The struggle between the oppressed and the oppressors, between those in power and those who apparently are powerless. It is a class struggle. Now, I'm using the term class struggle. It's a Marxist term, but the reality of class struggle long preceded Marx. It wasn't something that Marx invented. He simply used that title to describe what has gone on for centuries, for thousands of years, that those people who are in power are at odds with and struggle with those who are at a lower class in society. And what we want to do in this particular text now is to look at God's relationship to the particular classes in the society and the process of liberation whereby those people are brought from being members of the oppressed society to liberation, and what that means. All right, that's preliminary. Any questions? Now, let's turn first to Exodus chapter 1, those of you who have a Bible, verse 8. This is the story now, the beginning of the process of liberation. And it's the process and plan of liberation, rather than the fact of it, which I am interested in, and Moses' particular role in that particular process. I've entitled this, Moses the Militant, with a question mark. Is he a militant leader or is he something else? What is Moses' particular function? Verse 8. Now there arose a king in Egypt who did not know Joseph. And he said to his people, Behold, the people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply, and if war befall us, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land. In liberation struggles throughout the world, you'll find that as soon as the underclass either gets very large or gets some kind of significant advantage, there will be an effort on the part of the ruling class to control them. Various techniques of control. The problem here was that these people were living well enough to be able to increase and multiply. And in South Africa, we've heard that the blacks are, of course, far outnumber the whites. And that's part of the problem, the sheer potential of numbers. And exactly this same problem is here. Egypt sees the sheer potential of what will happen if Israel keeps to multiply and gets bigger and bigger. The similar process in Sri Lanka, where I'm somewhat familiar with the problem. In Sri Lanka, the effort to contain the Tamils who went there 400 years ago, 200 years, various times in the past, and have established themselves and become very good businessmen and become a threat to society. And so the other people have to find ways of controlling and containing them. And so the struggle there for liberation of the Tamils in Sri Lanka also continues. And I was caught up in the middle of that. If there's time somewhere, I will talk about that. Now, the struggle is there, and it's clear that the two sides are those who have no power, the people who are the slaves, which is Israel, and the Egyptian rulers who are using them. So what they did was to take these particular people, the slaves, and give them a very large and onerous task, put them to work, and somehow or another contain them, and often those kind of works also produced a lot of deaths and a lot more hardship, and it made it more difficult for people to survive. Israel, however, thrived on the hardship in this particular case, or at least so the story says. By the way, this kind of mass labor, taking thousands and thousands to do a job by building the pyramids, is traditional all over the world, and I still see it in India. We want to build a building, we get 500 people and just cut the rocks from one place to the other, and it's done, you know. Mass labor is still a reality in this world, the kind of mass labor that you're talking about here. All right. They increased the rigor and they increased the oppression on the people. Now, the second trick of the trade was to say, well, look, they're still multiplying. We've got to somehow or another have population control. So the way we'll control the population is that whenever a boy child is to be born, that we will have the midwives, whose role it was to deliver the child, kill the child and say, look, the baby was born dead. You know, there's a way of dealing with it. Every baby is born, the mother's not very alert, and the baby is easily dies, frequently dies at birth. So they have a process of killing the babies when they're first born. I think it was the baby boys, or did it say boys and girls? Boys. It's very clear in India that boys are valuable and girls are worthless. So it doesn't matter if the girls are born. They're not going to be any threat or any value. And we experience that all the time. They let the baby girls die. The boys, of course, would be well. You have twins. The boy is very healthy. The girl is miserable. It's a typical situation throughout ancient world and even in many societies like India today. So they would kill the baby boys. That was the plan. Now, the first heroes of the resistance are really heroines. What do the midwives do?
They feared God and didn't obey the
king. Yeah, and how did they get around it? What would they actually do?
They said that Israeli women were stronger than the Egyptian women, and they had their children before the midwives could come.
Right, they lied in their teeth. They said to the rulers, look, by the time we get there, the kid's running around and gone, you know. They're so vigorous, these women, the kids jump out, and they have, the whole idea is that they were able to somehow cover. So the first heroes or heroines of the resistance, and this is typical of the process of devices to survive against oppressive processes. And I'm sure there are other people here who could tell you 101 other devices of how the poor, how the oppressed survive in spite of the oppression and the techniques of survival. And this is one example. And the first heroines of the oppression are these midwives. That's step one. Then, step two, by the way, it's perfectly normal to lie in these situations, to tell an untruth in the politics in order to be able to make it. Next. Then they said, well, they're not dying, so what we'll do is we'll ask them to throw all the babies that are born into the Nile, all the baby boys. Why didn't they just go around and kill them all? Why did they have the midwives do the killing and then have the people throw the kids in the Nile? Why in the process of oppression is this the technique that's used?
Some sort of rationale, I don't know.
Politics.
Yeah, but why is this good politics?
They fix the blame,
they dehumanize, and in fact it's designed to demoralize. If you have to kill your own children, it's a much more insidious form of oppression than if somebody else kills your child. Ugly. Two different ways they were trying to get their own people to find a way to control their population and kill themselves. It's therefore much more insidious. And it is typical of processes that are used in oppression to control people. Inhuman techniques of one kind or another, and these were two examples of that. Well, one baby, of course, that was thrown in the Nile, everybody knows, was Moses. And he's thrown in the river and is found by this princess or somebody and taken to live in the court, which puts Moses in a different position than anybody else, because once he's no longer just an Israelite, he's an Israelite who is
prince,
equivalent to a prince. He'll be educated, he'll be sophisticated, he'll suddenly be amongst the
elite
instead of just being one of the others. And he will understand the Egyptian politics as much as he, well, at least initially he'll understand that more than he'll understand his own people. And it's important to understand that Moses is in fact in both camps. He has born in one camp and has his roots there, but has his education and his preparation for being a liberator in the other camp, in the palace of the prince. Then comes what I would say stage two in the process of liberation. And those who have gone through this, please correct me if what I'm saying doesn't quite jive with the reality of your world. I see people from South Africa, I don't know whether there are other groups that are here as well. The second stage in this is a stage in which you have the sensitization of the leader, who is Moses. He walks out one day and he sees an Egyptian fighting with an Israelite. And he realizes that his roots are more important than his position. And so he does what? Kills the Egyptian and buries him in the sand. And that seems to be okay. It's quite clear that suddenly his allegiance, the roots of his roots, are far more important than his status. And it's this sensitization process of some key people that are important in the liberation process in so many parts of the world. Now, this particular case seems to be straightforward, excepting that next day he sees two Hebrews, two Israelites fighting, and he says, "Why are you fighting?" And they say to him, "Shut up, Buster, who are you to tell us what to do? We want to fight, we can fight. You're going to kill one of us too." What's happened?
He responded out.
Well, clearly the guy who got his neck saved told about what had happened. But what else is happening here? Why do they reject him? Why do they reject him as an arbiter in their case?
Well, he's been brought up as an Egyptian.
Right. He's not a real one.
No.
Not at this point, is he? No. So in spite of the fact that he may have seemed to give his identity there, he's still really part of the upper class. Who are you to talk to us, you know? You've been up there, you're one of the... So right, you live in a lush palace. The class difference was there. Moses was still not one of them, was he?
No.
So they really weren't going to listen to him. And that also meant that the story was out that he had done this killing, and therefore he was in trouble. So Moses does what? Flees for his life and goes and lives in Midian and finds himself a wife and some goats and has a happy life there for quite a while. And you also have in many of these cases this kind of period of exile of preparing somebody for the process of... Sometimes they're in exile in prison, sometimes they're in exile in other situations. Very often the leaders of great movements are people who were in exile or were out of it quite a time, and then suddenly the call comes. Before we go to Moses' actual commissioning, let's turn to the great classic passage that's always quoted at the end of Exodus chapter 2. And just be clear what it is that's going on there. Exodus chapter 2, verses 23 and 24. In the course of those many days, the king of Egypt died, and the people of Israel groaned under their bondage and cried out for help. And their cry and the bondage came to God, and God heard their groaning, and God remembered the covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. This is the passage that's regularly quoted. What have we got? A class struggle in which the bottom of the barrel, people of Israel, the slaves, are struggling against the ruling class of Egypt. They cry out in their agony and become aware of the struggle and the nature of the struggle, and then God himself hears and becomes aware of the struggle, and then what does God do? Take sides with the slaves, the oppressed. Now, that seems to be something that we've always taken fairly easily, but you also have to realize that in doing so, God has taken sides in a political conflict. And I can remember when I went to seminary and studied and grew up, the whole picture was, look, politics and religion don't mix them or you're in trouble. And that was the way in which I was taught. And it's always been difficult for me to try and go through the process of overcoming that. But it is very clear that in this particular case, as in any number of other places throughout the whole Old Testament, God is taking sides with somebody in a political conflict, whether we like it or not. And the people that he's taking sides with are the lower class, in the class struggle here, the poor. God takes sides with the poor. And that's the classic statement of black theology and South American theology and so on, and the theology of poverty. So this passage, this point, is pivotal, and it's one thing for us to intellectually say it. It's another thing to say, where do I stand? Because after all is said and done, you and I are not at the bottom class. We are on the ruling class. And that's where, as we go through, we have to begin to come to terms with ourselves. We are members of the elite ruling class. And Robert McAfee Brown, in his little book, talks about that whole problem, that in Chile, the Americans were heavily involved in the process of supporting the dictator, and how the poor people can say the Americans are on the side of the oppressors because the American government has clearly supported that. And so God is not on the side of the Americans, he's on the side of the oppressed people. And this maybe oversimplification, but that kind of logic comes out as a result of this kind of understanding of a text like this. And this is the key text, a key text in all of this.
If we look at verse 24 here, it says, God remembered his covenant.
Right.
Now this suggests perhaps another interpretation, which I think a lot of Christians would make, that God is taking sides on the basis of there's this one group I have made a covenant with, fighting another group that's somehow outside of my covenant, and that this is the basis rather than oppressed and oppressors on which God is taking sides at this point.
There's a certain point to what you say, that's true. God makes this commitment to these people because he also had a promise that he would support these people. The covenant promise is there. But it's also very clear, if you go to the prophets, the ground on which Israel is going to suffer as oppressors when they come to that point is precisely because they're people of the covenant and should have known better that God is in the covenant. God is the covenant God is the God of the oppressed. So that even if the covenant is there, it's still true that God is siding with those people, and that the covenant people are not meant to be people who are oppressors. And so if you've got oppressors, if his own people become oppressors, then, say, Jeremiah and Amos and so on, God will treat you the same way as he treated the Egyptians. That's fair enough. That's what this theology would say, that God always will be on the side of those who are struggling for justice. Any other comments? Okay. Now let's take Moses' actual commission in chapter 3. Moses is out in the wilderness, you remember, and he sees this bush burning, and God talks to him. He says, "Hey, Moses, old boy, I'm here." And Moses says, "Yep, old boy. Yeah, all right, I hear you." And Moses doesn't want to hear anything. Moses is very reluctant, very hesitant. And then finally God says, "Look, I have seen the affliction," verse 7, "of the people of Israel. I've seen what they're doing to the people. I am coming down now to deliver the people from their hardships and from their oppression and take them to the promised land." Verse 9. "And now behold, the cry of the people of Israel has come to me, and I have seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppressed them. Come, I will send you, Moses, to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the sons of Israel, out of Egypt." Well, Moses' initial reaction is say, "You gotta be kidding, God. Wait a minute. What am I doing that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the sons of Israel out of Egypt?" Now, it is also typical of the great leaders who are called throughout the Old Testament that their first response is, "Not me. Forget it, forget it. I don't want to go." That is typical of Saul, it's typical of Gideon, you can name it. Right down the line, this is typical. Now, Moses is the same. He has a pretty bad track record back in Egypt. Why go back? Why else would Moses not want to go?
He's happy where he is.
It's nice looking after you, God. It's a nice wife, family, and everything. Wife. Comfortable where he was. What else?
I think he's afraid he might fail. He keeps saying that over and over again. "Are you sure they're going to believe me?" And I spend.
Right. Yeah, first of all, I'm going to fail because nobody's going to believe me. First of all, he's a problem in terms of he did belong to the other class. He's tainted. Can you really trust this guy? After all, he lived in the prince's court. Can you really trust Moses? That's it. The second thing is, as you mentioned, he says, "Well, I stutter. I don't know how to say anything." And God says, "Oh, forget it. Try Moses, Aaron. Get somebody else to talk for you. We can easily overcome that." And this whole business about all sorts of excuses, all sorts of reasons why he shouldn't be the one. And finally, he agrees to go if Aaron does all the talking. A front man. Fair enough. So Moses finally is called to be the leader of the great revolution. Not that he wants to be, but sensitized, forced, called, and I think a lot of leaders have the same ambivalence, called to do this kind of job, knowing that it's dangerous, knowing it can very well fail, and so on. And yet he goes. Questions? Yes?
This is just a point of detail. Where did Aaron come from? Is he really a blood brother, or is he just a relative?
He's not a blood, he's a relative.
Okay.
But the important thing about Aaron is that Israel in a slavery wasn't just totally disorganized. There were groups within it. There were people who were playing the role of priests and so on. There were elders. They had kind of groupings within that. And Aaron was not one of the fools, he was one of them. They had processes, apparently oral education that was going on. And Aaron was one of the more educated, one of the leaders of the people. They had their own leaders. You don't hear much or know much about it, but certainly, you take slave groups. We've been just working with some groups up Tamil refugees up in who were slaves to companies up in the hills of Kodaikanal. And there are people within the community that are recognized as the elders or leaders of that one kind. And in this particular case, an articulate man. Aaron is the spokesman, the articulate one. Moses is the power behind it all. And of course, God gives him a few tricks up his sleeve. You can pull out a snake when you want to, and these various other things, which will help to support his case. But the real speaker is supposed to be Aaron. Yeah.
What does it mean in the Bible? It says on Moses' way up to Egypt, God tried to kill him, and they had he circumcised his.
That particular story about the question that's asked is about Zipporah. In 4 chapter, verse 24, it's a question about that's really quite unrelated to this topic, but we'll deal with it since it's here. At a lodging place on the way, the Lord met him and sought to kill him. Now you remember a similar struggle happened between Jacob and the angel of the Lord back in Genesis. So you've got this extraordinary thing where it's as though God, Moses is struggling with God, and then there's a story about how Zipporah took a flint stone and cut off his son's foreskin and touched Moses' feet with it and said, "Surely you're a bloody bridegroom to me." So she let him alone. So he let him alone, and then it was said, "You are the bridegroom of blood because of circumcision." Now, there's a very strange, and there are 100 interpretations of this passage. So what I tell you will be as one big a guess as anybody else's. It's also related to the fact that I think in some way or another, going through the process of circumcision means that Abraham, Moses was made really one with the Israelites as well. Second, there's something there about the whole process of Zipporah and her marriage relationship with Moses and the necessity of binding that with blood. And there are all kinds of versions of the story. It doesn't have anything to do with this. It's a little piece put in there. And the main circumcision story is, of course, in Genesis chapter 17. And this one here seems to be some kind of ritual that sort of assures that Moses is now going to be acceptable to God and everybody else to go back to his own people. Exactly how it clicks, your guess is as good as mine. But there are mysterious passages like that in the Bible. And even if you study it for 30 years, you won't have all the answers. All right. Then chapter 5 comes the actual first stage of the struggle. Chapter 5, verse 1. Moses and Aaron went to Pharaoh and said, "Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, let my people go, that they may hold a feast in the wilderness." And earlier it says that's to be a three-day feast. So the first effort is they go to Pharaoh and say, "We want a long weekend. 3 days to go and have a bit of a festival." Why did they ask for a long weekend? Why didn't they ask, "Look, we want to leave and go"? Typical of a lot of these struggles is that you ask for a small concession first. And you move piece by piece in the concessions that you're asking for and the struggle that you're asking for. And of course, where you've got a very liberal leadership who was oppressing with a kind of liberal attitude, such concessions will be granted because it will pacify the troublemakers. But if you've got an oppressive group that isn't enlightened in that sense, they will then react to such requests for a concession of some kind by increasing the oppression, by increasing the problem. And in this particular case, the reaction was that of some people who said, "Well, you asked for a three-day weekend. What we'll do is you must be idle, you must have plenty of time on your hands, therefore we'll increase the burden." So the whole process of how the first stage of the struggle for freedom happens is to ask for an initial concession, to begin to get some kind of foot in the door, as it were, in the dialogue, in the struggle with the ruling power. The test case. And of course, what happens? Instead of saying, "Yes, we can have a little time off," which would have been very smart, just the opposite happens. And instead of having to make their own bricks and have the straw supplied, they now have to find their own straw and keep the same tally of bricks and so on. So the oppression increases. What's the reaction on the part of the Israelites to that?
The king complaining.
They come to Moses and they say, Moses, what's happened now? We are now in a worse position than we were before. And that frequently happens. The first stages, as the stages of the struggle happen, it doesn't just happen overnight. There's a long struggle, and very often the plight of the people gets worse and worse and worse as time goes on. Now, we experienced just a little bit of that in the struggle. We were in South India, and the problem of Sri Lankan Tamil refugees was there. And quite a number of the Sri Lankans, refugees who were Tamils, had come over, and they had been an agreement that they could get all that they needed, education, food, and so forth, if they worked for a certain company, which was a logging type of logging company, a company that took wood and so on in the mountains. And they worked there for those people, but of course it really was slave labor. And they were enslaved to these people up in the mountains. Now, the struggle to be free is a long one. And one group of them decided that they would buy in on the struggle, and some, I won't go through the whole story, that's another story. But as a process, through Supreme Court decision, this group was declared that they were to be freed from the bonded labor of this company, and that the government was going to provide them with land and all the other things. Now, as a result of that, they may be literally out of work, but out of everything else too. They don't have food, they don't have proper money on time, they don't have land yet. And the processes, the struggle, is in fact worse for them now than it was before. The struggle is now against the government instead of the company. So you can point to 101 examples where the struggle to be free often means that you get into a worse and worse plight as the time goes on. Now, a little further on in chapter 5, then Moses, verse 22, turned again to the Lord and said, O Lord, why have you done this evil to your people? Why did you ever send me? And Moses complains that, in fact, he is now having to suffer the brunt of this, and it's an absolutely ridiculous situation because it's worse than it was before. Now, what does God answer? And I think this is a very important point that you should know. In verse 2, God said to Moses, 6 verse 2, I am Yahweh. I appeared to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob as God Almighty, or El Shaddai, but by the name Yahweh I did not make myself known to them. I want you to learn about a particular name. This name is the name that is revealed here. It's translated in the Bible as Lord in many passages. And in the old King James Version and some of the old songs, you get the word Jehovah. And Jehovah is really a strange word. Jehovah is a combination of things. The word Yahweh, which often is presented with a J, is this, J, H, and the vowels, the consonants of that word, when the Hebrew scribes and cantors read that, they never ever said Yahweh because that was the unmentionable name, that was the holy name. They always read the word Lord, which is Adonai. And they put the vowels for this word underneath the consonants for that word to remind them always to say Adonai, Lord, instead of the word Yahweh, which is the holy unmentionable name. But in the Middle Ages, when they were translating, they didn't know that, so they had the consonants of one word and the vowels of another. So Jehovah is not a real name, it's the consonants of one word and the vowels of another. Now, that's not important for our discussion. What is important is this name. This is the name of God that is revealed at that time. At what particular time? At the time of the great liberation of God's people, God gives a name. Yahweh is the liberation name of God. It's the covenant name of God. Abraham, it says, had another name for me. He knew me by the name of El Shaddai. El is a very common word. It means, it's a very common word for God. It's the great patriarchal God, the ancient God. And Shaddai, it's debated what that means. It probably means mountain. God of the great mountain, God of the cosmic mountain, God of the earth, something like that. But what is important is it tells you that historically, Abraham knew me by a name which is a very wide name, a common name like any other name, a male, which you can find all over the ancient Near East. At this point in time, the time when the liberation event happens, however, God's specific liberation covenant name is revealed to them through Moses. Is that clear? So that this name, every time you hear the word Yahweh, or word Lord, as it's translated often, you are hearing the specific name. And I think it's very unfortunate to translate it Lord, because you lose the distinctiveness of that name, which says to you, this is the God who sides with the oppressed and liberates his people. This ancient name is the name that is can apply to any gods. Certainly El can apply to many gods. But this name is distinctively and uniquely the name for the God of Israel, as the God who suffers and liberates the oppressed. Questions? Is that clear? And this name is revealed at this time in the middle of the crying and the oppression of God's people. Okay. Now let's turn a little further in chapter 6, 7, 8, 9. From this point on, what do you get? You get all of the plagues. Now there are 10 plagues in Israel. And those 10 plagues all are acts in which really are they acts of nature. You get boils on the cows, and you get frogs, and you get all kinds of things. If you were talking about the various processes of harassment of the ruling power today, what would be the equivalent of the plagues? Remember, these are the things that put the pressure on, that harass, that try to break the back of the ruling power.
Protests?
Terrorism. Yeah, actually terrorism. In many cases, it's exactly the sort of thing. Blowing up bridges really puts the pressure on. And the kind of groups that we were familiar with, the Tamil liberation movements in South India and in Sri Lanka, various techniques. Any others? Sanctions, somebody mentioned in the last one. They are techniques of a pressure brought on the ruling power to try and break their hold on the oppressed group. Any other suggestions?
International,
pressure, opinion.
Yeah, pressure, maybe, yeah, moral pressure.
United Nations. Yeah, today you would have United Nations. In that time, God is sort of like the United Nations here. I mean, he's outside of the actual local situation and is bringing the pressure to bear on that situation. That's
the
right.
World court in isolated instances.
Yeah, world court, Nicaragua and so on. But those are modern techniques. Here you've got a way of saying the process. Now notice the liberation of God's people by God wasn't a snap event. It went through these stages of sensitization of the people, early resistance of the people, then major pressures to break the back of the ruling power, right? And I won't go through all of those, they're just interesting. Till you get to the last one, and what is the event that finally cracks the government of Egypt?
Killing of the firstborn.
Killing of the firstborn son. Why is that so dramatic? I mean, you can lose a few people. Why is the killing of the firstborn son the thing that is like to break them?
Because
in the, or did break them. Why was that so significant?
Killing the heirs.
Right. The firstborn son is the one who has all of the rights, all of the control for the future, right? The power for the future. You are striking at the heart of the future power of the people, of the government. At least symbolically, that's what it means. Theoretically, of course, you could always have another son, you know, and so on. But, in fact, so that we tend to think of it, when we think about this particular passage, to say, well, it, you know, they didn't like to lose their poor little boy. There's a political dimension to all of these things, and not just a human dimension to all these stories. And that's the thing that I think, for years and years, I haven't really fully appreciated. So to some extent, what I'm talking about here, if you see political dimensions, you are as much at the forefront of the reading of this text politically as I am, because I have not studied this that way very much in my life. But there's a political dimension right there. In that, the firstborn is the one who will have the future power, and you are striking at the heart of the power of those people, the future power. Questions? Okay, then of course they do actually tell them to leave. Now it's also striking that when they leave, the Israelites do a little rip-off. In chapter 12. I'm not going to go through the Passover story, which everybody knows and which is fairly universally understood. But what is happening in that story is another dimension, in that there's a power of God over against the Egyptian God. So there's a battle at the other level. There's a kind of divine politics going on as well as to which side is going to win. That's brought into the picture. I won't go into that, simply to mention it. And point out that when they leave, they... Israelites take all kinds of things with them. They, you know, when we were leaving India, we were leaving India, the expectation was that, you know, people would come up to you in the street and like, if you've got any old boots or if you've got an old radio, when you're leaving, right, well, something happens at that separation point. Now here, when they want to get rid of these people, I say, take anything. Just take our gold, take our silver, just get out of here. And so the Israelites go with all kinds of stuff. Now, when you have a revolution, it's put a slightly different way. Huh? The revolutionaries frequently will loot and booty and all kinds of things, and shops will get burnt and goodness knows what else. And you go off with stuff. So that the haves get ripped off by the have-nots in the revolution. In an interesting way, this is done somewhat as though, well, please take it. Slightly different version to the story, but the same thing happens, that they go off with some of the things that belong to the haves. Let's take a couple of other little lines in here, which I'll ask you how you will read. Then Pharaoh, verse 31, summoned Moses and Aaron by night and said, rise up, get out, go forth from my people, both of you and the people of Israel, and go serve the Lord the way you said. At this point, he still thinks it's only a three-day weekend. Or at least that's the way the text is presented. Take your flocks and your herds, as you said, and be gone, and bless me also. Now that line, bless me also, can be read three or four different ways. How would you read it? Who's asking this? Pharaoh. The ruler, bless me also. Now, one of the great theologians by the name of Hans Walter Wolff, whom I studied with in Germany, said, you go through all of this picture of Israel. You remember Abraham was the one who's supposed to mediate blessing to all these different people. And even here, the possibility of Pharaoh getting the blessing is included. But there's another way of reading that. What does it mean if Pharaoh says, bless me also, when these people are going out?
This translation says, say farewell to me forever.
Say farewell to me forever. That, well, it might mean that, but then this would have to be a very sarcastic way of saying that. Huh?
Right.
And it may be that this is purely tongue-in-cheek, you know, he's saying, all right, get going, right, and bless me, do anything you can, right?
Just go away.
Just go away, and go and have your worship, and please pray for me, I need it, you know. And in many ways, that seems to be as likely. But that translation, of course, is not what the Hebrew says. The Hebrew says, bless me. Actually, the word bless is there, which means to ask God's favor upon the people who you just escaped from. And there's a certain ambivalence in a text like this. Because if he goes out and worships and prays for Pharaoh, then he's praying for his enemies. So there's all sorts of fascinating double entendres when you have a line like, just a short line, bless me also. Do you bless the oppressors? They would like it to think that the people who are going out now will feel good about the fact that my rulers have given me some time off. Those of us who are in administration always like to think that when we give a favor to somebody, people will feel happy and thankful. When it's a right, often. So there's a lot of things going on in that little line, bless me also. Now, since our time is starting to move on, I would like to say a word about what happens after this. They get out of Egypt, and you have the great spectacular Cecil B. DeMille version of how they got out of the land, or the parting of the waters and all of that. And that's all a beautiful coloring and glory and so on of the great Exodus event. But what I'd like to spend a little time with is to ask the question, what happens when you finally have a group of people who have been oppressed and suddenly they no longer have the oppressors on top of them? What happens?
Well, they complain to Moses.
Why?
They complain because they didn't have all the food that they wanted to eat like they had back when they were slaves. And
when we were slaves, we were better off.
Yeah.
They're still dependent, aren't they?
They still haven't learned sufficiency. They still have, and this whole thing, we also, you have become dependent. And suddenly, having lost your dependency, you're actually no longer under these people, but you haven't learned sufficiency, how to run your own world. Now, lots of revolutionaries will set up these great ideals about, we just got to get out. And I remember reading somewhere else, I was saying, well, you've got to have a plan of how you're going to organize your society when you do have the revolution. Those in the middle of it don't, usually. They don't. They say, nothing could be worse than this. And as soon as they get out in the wilderness, they say, there is something worse than this. Right? It's worse now. We don't have any of the leeks and onions and stuff we had when we were in Egypt. We had food there, at least. We had a job there, at least. Now we've got neither a job nor food. And we're out here in the middle of this wilderness and no land, no home, no nothing. That's the struggle. Now comes the second stage of the large stage of the process of liberation, and that is to organize your society. Isn't it? So the book of Exodus and Leviticus and Numbers is about the whole problem of organizing a society of people who are disenfranchised, who are now people left to their own devices without having any government or rulers, whether they're oppressors or not. Now that's not easy. And very often we only read this text of Genesis, of Exodus and Numbers, as kind of theological stuff about how God chose his people and covenant and tie it in and so on, when in fact it's very much about the very real business of a liberated group trying to form its own world. Now, one of the passages I suggested you read is a story about Jethro. Moses decides to go back and see his father-in-law and says, boy, this is rough. Huh? And his father-in-law is a very smart guy. And he says, Moses, you know, you really can't run the whole show yourself. You're an idiot. You've got all these thousands of people, you're trying to do every problem yourself. It's time you delegated a bit of authority. And so he proposes at least a first stage of a society to order, organize things. And in the process of the whole thing, you've got developed a proposal for an Israel which is essentially an egalitarian society, with Moses and other leaders as the people who are supposed to mediate God's will and therefore have what God wants as the way that that particular society is organized. They are the mediators, and then there's another group of elders who are beneath them. And it's, while there's a hierarchy, it's nothing like the hierarchy that you get under King Solomon later on. We had Solomon's picture, which was clearly he was a dictator, and everybody could rip off everybody else in the system. Now, it's very crucial in the picture of how this society ought to be set up in chapter 18. I'll just give you one or two lines. In chapter 18, when Jethro, the father-in-law, is telling Moses, this is the thing you ought to do. Make sure that when you choose the people who are going to be, as it were, your representatives over each of these groups. Verse 21. Choose able men from all the people, such as fear God, men who are trustworthy and who hate a bribe. Nothing could be more precise than that. Because that's precisely what happens in virtually every society where you have government officials, that there will be a way of them taking advantage of it and ripping off the system of bribes of one kind or another, which I've lived with for a number of years now in India. But the important thing is the process of building a new society and the stages that Israel goes through and the horrible complaints and the rebellion of the people in this struggle to form a new society. So the wilderness grumblings are the problem of an embryonic community growing into existence. And that's another way of beginning to see it, the political process of becoming a people. Now, we've got a few minutes left. First of all, any questions at this point? When the Israelites then formed this covenant, Moses has a covenant with the people. Yahweh will be their God, they will be his people, and these will be the laws of the people that they're supposed to have. Now that covenant in chapter 24 is in fact like a government constitution. We think of it strictly in terms of our tie-up with the Eucharist, right? The old covenant was in Exodus 24, the covenant with God's people and Moses. The new covenant is in Jesus Christ, and it's a spiritual tie that we have. Here, however, it's much more than a spiritual tie. It's also the structure of, it's virtually the constitution of these people. And that chapter in chapter 24 is the ritual whereby everybody agrees to the constitution. God will be in charge. Moses will represent him. There will be certain regulations that they will have to keep in order to be able to be a society and a people for God, and so on. And it's all sealed with blood in that covenant ritual. Now, that particular moment, you see, is just as political in many ways as it is theological. And so we need to keep in mind that kind of thing as we read the Old Testament texts like this as well. Now, are there any questions before I make one closing thing? Just for the moment, turn to Numbers, which I'd asked you to read. Numbers chapter 12. In Numbers 11, you have the wonderful problem of the fact that they got sick of eating manna every day. Manna dropped from heaven every day. So they said, look, we need a little meat. This is getting a bit much, having cereal every morning. We want a bit of ham with our pancakes. So God says, all right, these guys keep complaining and complaining and complaining. I'll tell you. So he sends this great pile of quail, and they get sick as a dog eating a quail. So he teaches them a lesson about complaining. But there is the struggle of having insufficient food. Well, let's take a look at some of these new societies. One of the great struggles is that they do have insufficient food in the new communities, don't they? It's a universal problem in those early stages. And so nothing unusual about this. We start to compare it to other similar liberation situations. Then just to keep you, give you a clear picture of what Moses was really like, I'd like to read to you a bit of chapter 12. Now the problem was that Moses, you see, had married this Cushite woman. Now a Cushite woman is what color? She's black. Moses married a black woman from Ethiopia. And there was a little problem about that. Where did she come in? The motley crew that was Israel weren't all sons of Abraham, by the way, that escaped from Egypt. That's another thing you have to realize. This group of people who came from Egypt are not just all children of Abraham. They're a motley crew. And there are other people, Cushites and goodness knows else, who got in on that, who were part of that group. So you're forming a community with an undisciplined, strange kind of group. Mixed multitudes, says the text. Anyway, he married this woman out there in the desert. Apparently he wasn't satisfied with having one wife, he had another one. Now, then they said to, Miriam said, and she was objecting, Miriam and Aaron, has the Lord spoken only through you, and has not he also spoken through us? Now there's a power play here going on. He has gotten married himself a foreigner, which is not on, and he thinks that, and yet he thinks he's God. By George, we've got something to say about that, and we're speaking for God as well. So there's a power play that went on between Miriam, Aaron on the one side, in the local liberation politics, and Moses on the other. And comes this wonderful text. You've just got to read it. Verse 3. Now the man Moses was very meek, more than all the men that were on the face of the earth. Now, if you've read the story of Moses, if anything that he isn't is meek. He's hard-nosed, he's tough, he yells, he screams at God, and yet he's portrayed here as meek. There's one of the little texts that you've got, have to be tongue-in-cheek, and are partly designed to set the conflict, set this person in conflict with the other people. Now, the story ends up that God is on Moses' side because he's such a meek and lovely man, and he's not on Miriam's side, and she gets smitten with leprosy as a result, so she gets this horrible disease because she dares to oppose Moses marrying this black woman. Very interesting little text. And last but not least, Moses then says, all right, it's time we went to the promised land, and sends out the spies. And so this group of people who have been freed from Egypt and are supposed to be now, have learnt dependency on God instead of dependency on Egypt, go out to look at the land they're supposed to conquer. And they go out there, and what do they discover?
It's inhabited.
It's inhabited by people, and they say, we feel like grasshoppers compared to them. We're not going to fight. So it's one thing to have a revolution to escape. That's another thing to have the capacity to go and take over your own land. And so for 40 years, they still go through the process of learning to organize themselves as a people before they enter the promised land. And the question of how this people, who have been oppressed by others, actually come to take their own land is another story, and I won't have time to tell you. But there's a great new book called The Tribes of Israel by Gottwald, which tells you that it's as much a peasant revolt as it is a great invasion. A lot of new information about how Israel actually did become people of the land. So that's another story. So the story today, Moses the militant, Moses the meek, Moses is first and foremost the liberator of God's people. And as such, he is not a lawgiver. He's made to be a lawgiver. What happens is, of course, that Moses, in the course of time, gets to be seen primarily as the one who has identified with the law instead of identified with the gospel, which is where, in fact, he is initially. Moses is first and foremost a man of the gospel, the liberator. And in time, unfortunately, he gets to be identified as a lawgiver. And the law and the gospel are at odds.